if these black riders, you know, trying to kill him weren't in the way, this really sounds like a pretty good, like, race description, you know, like of a track race or, like, you know, bike race. It's like, yeah, dude, he can write that too.
Yeah, right? No, it's epic.
It's like, the last lap.
Champion's career, is it going to be another monument for Peter Sagan? Sagan sits and has Delia exactly where he wants him at the moment. He's right on his wheel, ready to pound.
Yes, we are.
Nice. Another long chapter.
It's an important chapter.
Yeah, yeah. This is the end of book one, dude.
Yeah.
Dude, like, this is a... it's a mini finale.
For anyone not paying attention, end of book one of The Fellowship of the Ring, The Flight to the Ford.
So, some stuff to talk about today. So, we got to talk about the aftermath of the scene at the fire where Frodo got stabbed, of course.
Yes.
And then we got to talk about their actual journey, which was quite long. And that troll scene there especially. And then we got to talk about Glorfindel. And then we got to talk about that final race at the end. So it should be pretty good. But before that, Cliff's notes.
Okay. So Frodo wakes up in a daze, clutching the ring, surrounded by his anxious companions. Strider returns to camp with word that the Black Riders seem to have retreated, apparently surprised by the resistance they received the night before, and thinking that Frodo is mortally wounded. Strider tends to Frodo's wounds, using some rare herb that he's found, and speaking strange words over the hilt of the knife that the Black Rider stabbed Frodo with. Knowing they can't stay, the group starts off promptly, with Frodo on the pony and everyone else carrying the supplies. They are forced to cross the road to enter back into the protection of the forest, and they hear two distant screams as they do. In spite of the feeling of danger, they trek for day after day through unforgiving landscape, coming eventually to the River Horwell, which can only be crossed at a bridge on the road. They fear an ambush, but Strider finds a strange, beautiful green jewel in the mud while he's scouting, and takes it as a sign of good luck. They cross, unhindered. Back into the wilderness, the going gets tougher. They rise into the foothills and eventually a small mountain range, which they cross with some difficulty. It rains for days and spirits are low. Coming out of the mountains, however, they pick up a troll trail with some history for the Bagginses, which leads them down towards the next pinch point, a ford across a second river, the Loudwater, also known as Bruinen of Rivendell. With only a mile of flat, open land to go, they are ambushed by all nine Black Riders. Frodo escapes capture, just barely, on the elvish horse of Glorfindel, and is ultimately saved as he utters the names of Elbereth and Luthien.
Nice. Excellent job, Clifford. All right. Let's jump into it, though, because this is another big one. So, Frodo wakes up, clutching the ring by the fire, and then there's a quote here. At length, he gathered from Sam that they had seen nothing but the vague, shadowy shapes coming towards them. Suddenly, to his horror, Sam found that his master had vanished, and at that moment, a black shadow rushed past him, and he fell. He heard Frodo's voice, but it seemed to come from a great distance, or from under the earth, crying out strange words. I mean, that was like Sam's perspective, I guess, from what happened, you know, because we saw that incident from Frodo's perspective when he got stabbed, right?
Right. At which point, I mean, if you remember, there were kind of these, well, what Frodo put on the ring, so we might have forgotten, but that means he's invisible to all of his friends.
Right.
But he is definitely visible to the Black Riders wearing the ring, or we get that impression.
Yeah.
And he can see the Black Riders as these kind of ghastly looking kings, glowing white. Right.
Yeah, but so where Sam is,
his image of the whole scene was like almost an inverse or completely different from what his friends were seeing.
Well, and Sam, I mean, it almost seems like they said that they had the line "the black holes" in the last chapter, and I guess that's kind of just the best way to kind of understand the black shadow that goes past him. I mean, they probably had the. I guess they did have the cloaks on, but even that doesn't even matter. And like the Dark Knight, you just. It's just something that, like, there's something that walks by you that's sucking any sort of light away. Like,
right.
You can't see through it, period.
Right.
Which is, I don't know, it's kind of slightly hard to imagine, but...
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to our discussion last chapter of, like, can something be present? Can it affect the world if it's not real or something like that? And we were talking about shadows. Like,
yeah.
are shadows real? Are they just a lack of something? Are they a thing in and of themselves? And how, even though that's a weird sort of line of inquiry, it's actually backed up by physics in a way. How light is a particle and it can affect the world, but it's not actually matter. And your reference to black holes, I think, kind of goes in the same sort of thing, where black holes are an absence of light, but they're actually extremely heavy. You know, it's kind of in that very abstract world of physics, that's where everything sort of gets bent to,
yeah.
Like, all of a sudden, things that aren't real are very real. Diversion.
Maybe Tolkien was just mad about the allegory stuff, because everybody thought it was an allegory of World War II, but it was an allegory of quantum mechanics.
Some, yeah.
And nobody else picked that up until, you know,
yeah.
Later. Uh-huh. Okay, anyways, Strider comes back, and this is pretty critical that he was just like, he can't understand why the riders aren't attacking again.
Right.
I think we'll just wait until we finish the section to, like, comment on that, but yeah. it's if you know what the riders become later in these books, it's like, yeah, what are they doing? But anyways,
right.
Anyways, he comes back. He has Merry and Pippin put hot water on the wound, and then he pulls Sam aside, and he's got that quote there. You want to read that?
There seem only to have been five of the enemy. Why they were not all here, I don't know, but I don't think they expected to be resisted. They have drawn off for the time being, but not far, I fear. They will come again another night if we cannot escape. They are only waiting because they think that their purpose is almost accomplished and that the ring cannot fly much further. I fear, Sam, that they believe your master has a deadly wound that will subdue him to their will. We shall see. Sam choked with tears. Don't despair, said Strider. You must trust me now. Your Frodo is made of sterner stuff than I had guessed, though Gandalf hinted that it might prove so. He is not slain, and I think he will resist the evil power of the wound longer than his enemies expect. I will do all I can to help heal him. Guard him well while I am away.
So Strider goes out to, like, look for stuff. He comes back at dawn,
yeah.
And it turns out that he found one of the black cloaks lying there with the slash marks, and that was from Frodo's sword. But
right.
And then Strider goes on to say, he says, this was the stroke of Frodo's sword, the only hurt it did to his enemy, I fear, for it is unharmed, but all blades perish that pierce that dreadful king. More deadly to him was the name of Elbereth. So that's kind of interesting. Well, he's calling him a king, straight up, so...
Yes.
I'm actually almost wondering.
That's new, right?
Well, Frodo had seen, when he put on the ring, he saw that they were kingly shapes at the end of the last chapter.
Wearing crowns.
Right. So, like, yeah, there's some sort of kings or whatever, but Strider's already aware that they're king, which
now,
you wouldn't pick up just by wearing the hood.
I can't remember if we talked about it at all. Was there any suggestion in the last chapter that they are the corrupt kings of men or something like that?
I don't know. I don't think they never even mentioned Wraith in either of these chapters, but it's like, I don't know how we can go past this part without talking about that. So whether they did or not, and I don't think they actually did, but we know that they're nine, there's kings. So
right.
You know, if you're paying attention to that ring poem at the very beginning of the book, it's not a stretch to make the guess, and you would be correct to guess that these are the nine men that got the rings from Sauron originally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think we did mention that in our last one.
I'm checking real quick.
Yeah, but I mean, like, they didn't even mention, like, Wraiths, like, Ring Wraiths. Like, they never actually called them the Ring Wraiths, which is like, I don't know. We have to talk about this. And so for that, we had to spoil the evil part.
Uh-huh.
But we had no choice. I'm sorry, everyone. We had no choice.
Okay. I was curious if in the last chapter when we were learning more about the Black Riders, and we kind of dived into what we knew about them, if the word king was ever mentioned. But yeah, I don't think it was. I think this was a first.
Well, Frodo had seen, like, the Pale King right at the beginning of the chapter.
Right.
It says that. But yeah, other than that, yeah. I don't... Yeah, I'm not sure that we were actually...
So, anyways.
Talk. Yeah.
We have a better picture of who these Black Riders are.
Right.
And there's a handful of things going on here. So, one, we're not really sure what's going on, why the Black Riders retreated, why they're not currently attacking, what's going on there, why only five of them attacked and not all nine of them. But we also have some new little morsels of interesting stuff. There's the black cloak on the ground, and the suggestion that Frodo's knife just instantly was destroyed, or rather his blade perished when he tried to stab the king. However, saying the name Elbereth did some damage.
Right.
What do we make of that? Do we know anything else?
I think we mentioned that a little bit at the end of the last chapter. Like, that's just the power of... Words have power in this book, you know? Like, it's almost like a... Not a spell, like a magical spell, like, you know, with instructions or anything. Mm-hmm. But it's like you say a powerful word like Elbereth, who's, like, one of the, like, the head queen goddess who's of, like, the good guys, you know? And that just has power over... the darkness there.
And what was so important about Elbereth that we were discussing?
If you go back to that third chapter, she's the queen of the stars. Like, she created all the stars, and it was when she created the stars that the elves woke up. Like, the very first elves woke up ever.
My speculation was a little bit like she's sort of like the queen of light or something like that. Like, she represents the lightest light if the Black Riders are the darkest dark.
Anytime you hear her mentioned, Tolkien's thinking of, like, the Virgin Mary, too. For a real world example, anybody that says like Hail Mary or like Ave Maria or anything like that, take those all as references to that. Yeah, but then there was that knife too, and it was the long knife that they used to stab Frodo, and then it was notched to the edge, and then after Strider picked it up, it just vanished to the hilt. Like, the whole blade just vanished and crumpled away.
Yeah, well, notched at the edge suggests that some piece of it broke off inside of Frodo, right?
Right, and I don't know if we know that yet, but I believe that's what happens. Yeah, and that's actually probably why he's like so sick this whole time. Because Sam's gonna mention later, it's like, well, the wound healed up. Like, what the hell? But it's because I think it's because there's the tip inside his body.
But then there's some like dark magic at play, basically, because the knife like turns to ash or something, right?
Right.
As soon as Strider touches it,
yeah.
But he holds onto the hilt because it has this evil writing on it that he doesn't understand, but he thinks it might be kind of like a, you know, hair of the dog type thing for use in curing Frodo later.
Or like just important artifacts, you know, just take them with you. Crime scene stuff, right? You know, grab the weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So he's still trying to heal this wound though, because that's what he had gone out to find, was he found these leaves of a long plant. And he says, these leaves I have walked far to find. For this plant does not grow in the bare hills, but in the thickets away south of the road, I found it in the dark by the scent of its leaves. Okay, so, like, this kind of stuff is, like, this is where you're actually... I feel like the sword vanishing and then this, like, looking for special leaves, this is the kind of stuff where you get, like, the fantasy literature kind of part, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like, every fantasy story after this, it's like, oh, there's a special, you know, potion that they can make to heal themselves. And then, like, his sword's, like, really special or it glows or something. And it's like, this is where you're starting to stray towards that. Whereas there's other examples, more examples, where it's like, it sounds more just like the straight, like, Beowulf mythology stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's just, like, almost, like, rudimentary, but...
Although the stuff with healing, I don't know. Well, the suggestion of healing powers, I would actually say the hunting for the herbs type thing is like a, that exists in so many different cultures and like myths as like the, I think that there was once, that like that used to be medicine in a lot of ways. So there was a lot of like embedded knowledge about herbs and different things like that. But definitely the suggestion that like Strider has powers and he has like a certain amount of
I wouldn't say so much the leaves, it's finding like an herb, like, yeah, that fits with mythology clearly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think it's just like, oh, you find it by the scent of the leaves in some place where it's not supposed to grow. I mean, it's like, that's where, and like a couple of like the powers about it, you know, it's like you crush the leaf and it has like the sweet fragrance, and then since this wound's so hard, it might not have that much effect on it, so it's almost like, you know, like power levels in like a video game or something. But then the fragrance is refreshing too, you know, it calms the mind, you know, like, I mean, that was maybe that's still kind of mythological, but like the sword vanishing part, like that, I feel like that's like the fantasy stuff. Like, oh, he pulled out his special sword, you know, that was, well, I mean, you know, you do say like Thor's hammer or something in mythology, but so there was that vibe that I got there. There's that line that Frodo's sitting there thinking, because his arm, you know, he's feeling his lifeless arm, because he can't feel his arm. But he says, he bitterly regretted his foolishness and reproached himself for the weakness of will, for he now perceived that in putting on the ring, he obeyed not his own desire, but the commanding wish of his enemies. Which, that's kind of just like anytime anybody gives into like any sort of impulse, you know, like you eat a whole bag of Oreos, it's like, damn. Like, yeah, and anybody can kind of relate to that, right?
Right. And that is the feeling also of, like, you're not totally conscious of it while you're doing it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you're almost, like, under... You're, like, compelled by something else, and then you like, kind of wake up from that, and you're like, oh, my God, what did I just do?
Especially,
why,
like,
did I just do that?
Yeah, especially, like, Skinny Pop, that stuff. That stuff just goes away right away.
Like, what is that, the soda?
No, that's the that's the popcorn that's, like, in quotes, healthy. I don't know, but you just eat the whole thing.
Oh, right? Yeah, yeah,
because nobody can have self-control with that. And then it's also, like,
it just dissolves in your mouth.
Yeah, but it has, like, you know, just the...
It makes you skinny.
Well, it's the dietary one, but it's, like, well, somehow it's really good, obnoxiously good. I'm shocked, but I don't know, whatever. We're getting off topic there. So, yeah, but again, we didn't have... They never actually said Ring Race, but it's like, okay, basically everybody kind of knows these are the Ring Race if you have any sort of knowledge of the movies or books. If you don't, sorry, we had to spoil that part.
I think people will be okay.
Yeah, but it is weird, like, if you just know anything about what they become, it's for them to not, you know, at least press the attack further here, I think is just... That's almost like a plot hole.
Right.
Strider makes a point to try to say, like, oh, well, you know, they probably think the job's accomplished and you're just going to limp off and die soon. And, you know, like, they were somewhat resistant here. But I mean, it's like, you see what you see them become. It's just like, no way. Like, I mean, Strider might be a match for them, but let's just redo the attack.
Well, they think that they've got Frodo in their grip already. That's at least what Strider's thinking.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, like, the type of scene that you see all over the place. Action movies, at, like, so many different places, where it's, like, the bad guy is, you know, has a gun pointed to the head of the good guy, and is then, like, decides to monologue for a little bit, or, like, really, like, wants to drag out the last, you know, 5% of finishing the job and winning. And they decide to drag it out, and they get all sloppy and cocky, and then, you know, the good guys are able to swing around and save the day. It's like the same sort of thing here. It's like they suddenly start dallying because victory is in their reach.
Yeah, I guess. But, yeah, I mean, still, it's just, like, bad planning on their part, then. Because you can say that about every evil villain that does that, too. Like, Austin Powers makes fun of that. They're just like, oh, I'm not going to watch him die. I'm just going to leave him with one guard, you know, and I'm just going to assume the sharks, you know, end up beating him. I just assume that'll happen. Like, they're like, really? What? Like, the people, like, his own henchmen are, like, questioning it. Like, you're going to just go along with this? But I guess that's the best explanation here. And, I mean, Weathertop, though, it's like, yeah, they still do have, like, 2 weeks to go, so maybe the riders are like, oh, it's good. But I guess... I don't know. They had already been there for, like, 6 days already, at least, going with Strider. So they should have figured out that they got somebody that can kind of outsmart them, like, really hide out. But I don't know. Right.
So do you think, can we speculate? The Black Riders, they attack Frodo. They stab him. Frodo lashes out with his sword and also yells out the name of Elbereth. And then Strider, like, jumps out with the flaming branches or the flaming sticks.
Yeah.
So, was it the combination of all those things? Was it specifically Frodo saying Elbereth? Was it the fire? Why did they not, you know, why didn't they, like, fight? It seems more like they attacked, but they didn't really battle.
Yeah, I think, well, they did the job by stabbing him. So then they were like, okay, mission accomplished. Just wait for him.
We've got the harpoon in him type thing.
Yeah. And it's like, yeah, just reel him in later. But,
okay.
But yeah, Elbereth, I guess that, yeah, that did, like, maybe shoo him away a little bit, but I think the fire really helped too. You know,
okay.
If you watch the movie, it's Aragorn with the fire. But, yeah. All right, but let's move on. That's enough here. We gotta truck through some stuff.
All right, guard, begin the unnecessarily slow moving dipping mechanism. Close the tank.
Wait, aren't you even gonna watch them? They could get away.
No, no, no. I'm going to leave them alone and not actually witness them dying. I'm just going to assume it all went to plan. What?
I have a gun in my room. You give me 5 seconds, I'll get it. I'll come back down here. Boom! I'll blow their brains out.
Scott, you just don't get it, do you? You don't.
Danger is afoot, and regardless of what's behind the motivations of the Black Riders... They're not currently attacking, and so Strider, Sam, and all the rest think this is high time to be moving.
Right.
Because if they sit around, they're just going to be attacked again.
But the next question is, well, how's Frodo going to continue on this? He just got stabbed. He's, like, you know, in terrible shape. So they end up putting Frodo on the pony, and they take all the food and carry it themselves, right? And so they cut across the road. They hear a couple shrieks, like you said. They're going to take like the most direct way because the road just seems to be making like a bunch of loops. So this time...
Giant S curves or something.
Yeah, and this time it's going to go north. So they're just going to cut south of it straight across.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, then they said it's a cheerless, gloomy land, which is like, that's a bummer because everything else that they act... Besides that they literally tell us it's gloomy, this place actually sounds kind of cool to me. But I guess we'll just have to wait until Rivendell to see something cool. But we'll read a couple of stuff on that in a second. Do you want to read all that big quote there?
Away below them, they could see the road sweeping round the feet of the hills. And to their right, a gray river gleamed pale in the thin sunshine. In the distance, they glimpsed yet another river in a stony valley half veiled in mist. I'm afraid we must go back to the road here for a while, says Strider. We have now come to the river Horwell, that the elves call Mytheliel. It flows down out of the Ettenmoors, the Troll Fells north of Rivendell, and joins the Loudwater away in the south. Some call it the Grey Flood after that. It is a great water before it finds the sea. There is no way over it below its sources in the Ettenmoors, except by the last bridge on which the road crosses. What is the other river we can see far away there? Asked Merry. That is Loudwater, the Brennan of Rivendell, answered Strider. The road runs along the edge of the hills for many miles from the bridge to the ford of Brennan, but I have not yet thought how we shall cross that water. One river at a time. We shall be fortunate indeed if we do not find the last bridge held against us.
Mm-hmm. So they get to this bridge. Strider checks it. It's totally clear, which is strange. And then on the bridge itself, he finds a single pale green jewel. And so he takes that as a sign of hope that somebody's like maybe guarding it or is allowing them to pass.
Yeah, because he's like, this could have been dropped or could have been placed.
Right.
But it looks like it might be elven.
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of got that sort of beauty to it.
Yeah.
And that's a good sign in general.
Yeah. So they keep moving on. Like, and days are kind of just passing real quick here. Because like we just said, they passed the bridge, I think, 6 days after Weathertop. They soon were lost in a somber country of dark trees winding among the feet of sullen hills. And then there's another quote here. As they went forward, the hills about them steadily rose. Here and there upon heights and ridges, they caught glimpses of ancient walls of stone and the ruins of towers. They had an ominous look. So they said this land's literally cheerless, like purposely directly said this is like a gloomy place. But
right. I don't know. And he's cool. Taking wooded hills. Definitely. I mean, it sounds like an interesting landscape. This is making me think of like maybe like the Black Hills or something. It's kind of what I have in my mind.
Okay, that's more accurate, but I was thinking more local for us that nobody else can relate to. Payless, you know, like the trails running up.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
Yeah, I like
that. Yeah, like kind of like somewhere in between like scrub brush and forest.
Right, yeah. Maybe Michigan, like wooded dunes, you know, like the dunes.
Yeah, although the Midwest, like the Midwest forest, like Michigan forest, actually has a lot of like really rich hardwoods. Like it's kind of like very fecund.
Okay, so Michigan's too pretty.
Yeah, like too like big and fertile and lush.
Nice.
It's got to be like drier and a little rougher, spikier.
Nice.
I was going to say that Tolkien's not missing a chance, like... If his descriptions that they're in kind of rough country is not enough, it's like he's throwing in dark trees and sullen hills, you know, somber country. Like every noun is being modified with like a sort of depressing adjective, which is a funny aspect. But
dude, he's a master of the landscapes. Like everybody, even his critics, give him credit for that. He's a master of landscapes. We'll keep watching for that in this book if you haven't. All right.
Yeah, but he's landing on thick here. This is
right.
In case this sounds like they're just cruising along, I mean they've been going for like a week at this point, and
from Weathertop.
Weathertop, which how long did it take them to get to Weathertop? About a week from Bree.
Yeah.
So and all this has been like hard cross country bushwhacking, basically, with Strider at their lead. So this is, I think we should not undermine how like just simply exhausting this has got to be as like a kind of the baseline for what they're going through. Not to mention all these other little adventures or challenges along the way.
Right. But while they see these ruins, Strider, he's got the quote here. No one lives in this land. Men once dwelt here ages ago, but none now remain. They became an evil people, as legends tell, for they fell under the shadow of Angmar. But all were destroyed in the war that brought the North Kingdom to its end. But that is now so long ago that the hills have forgotten them, though a shadow still lies on the land. So again, this is like, it's okay, so it's gloomy because literally the people that used to live here are turned evil. And then now, like, the land's still depressed from it, even though it doesn't even remember them, apparently.
Right, it's like a corrupted landscape or something like that. Pippin wants to know where Strider learned all this.
And Strider says, the heirs of Elendil do not forget all things past, and many more things than I can tell are remembered in Rivendell. And Frodo's wondering, so you've been to Rivendell often then? And Strider goes on to say, I dwelt there once, there my heart is, but it is not my fate to sit in peace, even in the fair house of Elrond, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
As we talk about the landscape there, we learn more about Strider right away. Because heir of Elendil, do we remember who Elendil is?
Elendil is the one who forged the Silmarils. Is that right? No. No, 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 no.
That's even close.
No, help me out. Elendil?
You're going to think it's Arendil, who's the mariner.
Oh.
But
never mind.
Elendil is the dad of Isildur.
Who was the man,
yes,
the head of the king of men who went up against, what's his name, Morgoth in the Last Alliance.
Well, no, he went against Sauron in the Last Alliance. Oh, Elendil Sauron, was okay. The leader of men in the Last Alliance with Gil-galad, and then they both get killed, and Isildur is the one that cuts the ring. And Isildur is Elendil's son.
Okay, so Elendil is among the most important men on the good guy
right.
side.
And so Strider's saying he's a descendant of them, which that might have been kind of a spoiler that we know who Elendil is. Maybe we should have just left him like, oh, he just is some kind of important guy. No. He's a big, big deal. So Strider's the descendant of them. I guess we won't play that up too much, the significance of that, until later in this book. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, that's important. And then he also says he's lived in Rivendell.
Yeah. Both of these, I'd say, are... sound a little bit more royal than what we've learned of Strider so far, that he's kind of this like hard-living cowboy who drifts around in like wild now, country. Basically, we knew up to this point that he's skilled and that he's knowledgeable, but this suggests there's more importance to him. Maybe what we've gathered from this, there are two pinch points on this route between Weathertop and where they need to go, where they're cutting through forest hills, kind of making their rough, slow way through the country, avoiding the road where they think the Black Riders are. But there's two points where they can't escape. They have to get on the road to cross these two rivers. So the first
one...
Well,
we already did we did the first one.
Well, yeah. So they found... Strider found the jewel... Okay, sorry. We've already been through this. They made it through one pinch point. Now you've got a bunch of rough going now, and there's another pinch point up ahead. And they're starting to run low on supplies, and it started raining. So things are getting pretty rough. Strider's a little nervous. They're going to start running out of food soon. It's been 10 days since Weathertop. And then they realize they've gone too far north.
Right, so they got to truck back south, but at this point, Frodo's like starting to almost like hallucinate. It sounds like, and the bad conditions are making him worse off too, which is pretty logical, just without even thinking about the magical powers of it, you know.
Right, Sam's really worried about him, and is trying to figure out. He's like, you know, what's good? Is he gonna die? What's wrong with him? And Strider responds, "Frodo has been touched by the weapons of the enemy, and there is some poison or evil at work that is beyond my skill to drive out. But do not give up hope, Sam."
Right. Later that night, Frodo's having nightmares. No surprise. They're sleeping out on some ridge because they have to cross it to get back over. They're kind of close to the ford. And then Strider says, like, all right, we're going to have to just find the road and chance it the rest of the way. And then they come across a troll hole. And then they're walking ahead. And Merry and Pippin, the troll holes seem to be empty. And Merry and Pippin, they're walking ahead, and they report back that they're scared that there's trolls up ahead. And so Strider, he grabs a stick, and he's like pretty curious about this and walks towards it. Now, if you're reading closely, Frodo kind of knows what's coming too. But Strider just walks up, smashes a stick on these trolls, and then they all realize these are the trolls turned to stone by Bilbo.
From The Hobbit.
Right, from The Hobbit, yeah. Like Bilbo's adventure there. Which I think this is kind of cool for two points. Or actually, no, just one point, and then I have something else to say. It's cool that, like, throughout the, we've been interweaving, like, ancient history and everything, but now here's history that we've already been a part of in this, like, these series of books, you know? And, like, right. that's, like, refreshing, probably, to the audience. It's like, oh, we actually know this one, you know? we remember this one, and we can, like, hearken back to it, right? Which is kind of cool. Also noteworthy.
And it's a little, it's almost a little bit playful for the hobbits as well, right? Because this is a story they grew up hearing from Bilbo as kind of like a bedtime story. It was his first big adventure.
Yeah, well, Pippin even says in here, like, there's that quote. He's like, oh, I had no idea we were close to this place. And the author reveals, or the narrator reveals, like, as a matter of fact, he had never more than half believed the story itself. Like, because he had heard it, like, a dozen times. But it's like, yeah, okay. Bilbo went on this adventure and he saw this. But he thought that was just, like, you know, a tall tale, basically. And it's like, oh, shoot, this was real. So this is getting real. Really real. And Strider also points out too, it's like, well, it's broad daylight, you remember that story, you know, so you don't remember your own family story, but then you don't remember anything about trolls, because we know that in the daylight is when they turn to stone, so how could they have been out here? Plus there's a bird's nest in one of them, right? What are you thinking?
But it's the point being, this is sort of an upbeat moment for them. This is like a throwback to, at least I see it as like a throwback to a lighter past. Yeah. When like the stakes were lower,
right?
This was a scary adventure for Bilbo, and it's now, certainly they're not diminishing that, but it doesn't carry the same weight. The prospect of running into a troll, which was life-threatening for Bilbo, is now a little bit, like, passive for these guys. It's a background concern.
Yeah, and so they're in good enough of a mood that Merry's asking for a song, because they haven't had any song since Weathertop, and so I guess they goad Sam into singing one, and so he's like, well, this isn't proper poetry, but he goes and sings the troll song.
Standing up with his hands behind his back as if he was at school, he began to sing to an old tune. A troll sat alone on his seat of stone and munched and mumbled a bare old bone. For many a year he had gnawed it near for meat was hard to come by, some by, gum by. In a cave in the hills he dwelt alone, and meat was hard to come by. Up came John with his big boots on, says he to troll, pray what is yon? For it looks like the shin of an Uncle Jim, as should be a line in graveyard, caveyard, paveyard. This many a year has Jim been gone, and I thought he were lying in graveyard. My lad said, troll, this bone I stole, but what be bones that lie in a hole? Thine uncle was dead as a lump of lead, afore I found his carcass. Harky, marky, he can spare a bone for a poor old troll. He's got no use for his carcass. Said John, I don't see where the likes of thee, with an axe and leave, should go make him free. With a leg of the shin of my father's skin, so hand the old bone over, rover, trover. Though dead he be, belongs to he, so hand the old bone over. For a couple of pins, says the troll and grins, I'll eat thee too and gnaw thy shins. A bit of fresh meat will go down sweet. Thee'll be a nice change from thy uncle, sunkle, drunkle. I'm tired of gnawing old bones and skins. Thee'll be a nice change from thy uncle. But just as he thought his dinner was cut, he found his hands had hold of naught. Before he could mind, John slipped behind and gave him the boot to land him. Warn him, darn him, a bump of the boot in the seat, John thought, would be the way to learn him. But harder than stone is the flesh and bone of a troll that sits in the hills alone. As well set your boot to the mountain's root, for the seat of a troll don't feel it, deal it, feel it. Old troll laughed, but John did groan, for his poor toes did feel it. John's leg is game since home he came, and his bootless foot is lasting lame. But troll don't care, and he is still there, with a bony bone from its owner. Donor, boner, troll's old seat is still the same, with a bony bone from its owner.
We have reverence for Strider because he knows all this lore, or at least you should. Right. Tolkien's trying to really harp on, like, that's a good quality. But low-key, Sam's pretty good with, like, tales and lore himself, you know, which is like,
right,
pretty unexpected. Like, Frodo's even got the line, I'm learning a lot more about Sam Gamgee on this journey. First he was a conspirator, now he's a jester. He'll end by becoming a wizard or a warrior. Ooh, maybe foreshadowing too. But I mean, it's like, yeah, you, yeah, learning tons about Sam here. Yeah, when you first meet him, you wouldn't think like he has much going on in his head, just bluntly.
So there's a suggestion he's not very well educated and he's kind of just like a country boy. But apparently he's super curious about everything that Bilbo talked about, really curious about the outside world, and so he just sucked up all of these old tales and stories and myths about elves and trolls and dwarves. And
I'll just say too, I think Sean Astin did a good job with him in the movies. I think he like pretty much nailed it. All right, last thing about this before we move on to Glorfindel. There's this quote in Tom Shippey's books. When Tolkien drew his maps and covered them with names, he felt no need to bring all the names into the story. Like, we kept hearing about Entenmoors. What the hell are Entenmoors? No idea. I think it's where trolls live, actually. But anyways, they do their work by suggesting that there's a world outside the story, that the story is only a selection. And the same goes for the hints of other creatures unaffected by an uninterested plot. Middle-earth is different from its many imitators in its density, its redundancy, and consequently its depth. And book one of The Lord of the Rings, which we're about to finish, does a great deal to create that depth. What was next, though, was a greater degree of narrative urgency.
Interesting.
More to say on that later, but it's like, yeah, this is just an adventure to like get to Rivendell, and it's almost like tunnel vision. Like, let's get there. Besides that, it's not really tunnel vision because we're hearing about all these other stuff. Right. But we're just like focused on, all right, get to Rivendell, and that's like the whole point of the story. You know, like, mm-hmm, we don't really... The overall plot is actually pretty weak besides, like, get to Rivendell because stuff is attacking us. You know, like, tunnel vision right there. And then, yeah, but he's got going on, which, yeah, adds the depth. Let's keep going, though, because we're doing terrible on time.
So, the group has made it over this mountain ridge line. Spirits are getting a little bit better. The sun has come out a little bit. They've kind of passed by the trolls, and spirits are rising. And so they know they're getting a little bit closer to the river. And then they hear footsteps behind them.
Well, hoofbeats. Well, now they're back on the road. They get back on the road at duskish, and then as soon as they're on there, they hear hoofbeats, and they're like, "Oh shit." Like, what right. is this? So again, they quickly run off the road, then up into the bushes high up, because like the road seems like it's like a bit of a valley, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
But what was going on with the hoofbeats? What did they hear with it? This kind of cool detail.
Little ringing bells.
Yeah, that's nice. That's a good idea.
Like a faint little tinkle.
Yeah, dude. Like, especially like when in these dangerous times, to have it's a pretty bold statement to have the little ringing bells there. To alert people that who you are. So, yeah, so because of the bells, Frodo and Strider are kind of like, hey, this probably isn't going to be a black rider.
And there's something that they can't really place about the hoofbeats that sounds a little more upbeat.
Right.
A little je ne sais quoi. I'm joking.
Yeah. But then the story reads here, suddenly into view below came a white horse, gleaming in the shadows, running swiftly. In the dusk, its headstall flickered and flashed, as if it were studded with gems like living stars. The rider's cloak streamed behind him, and his hood was thrown back. His golden hair flowed, shimmering in the wind of speed. To Frodo, it appeared that a white light was shining through the form and raiment of a rider, as if through a thin veil. That's a pretty cool description.
Definitely. I mean, verging on, like, fully angelic, yeah. I would say. He's, almost actively emitting light. I think everything is stopping short of saying that he's, like, glowing or shining. But certainly, like, the second you see this guy and this horse, like, you know that they're important and glorious, good. It's in the same way that that Tolkien set up, like, everything is, like, the most epic version of itself. You know, like the black riders are like these black holes, and here we have something kind of like the opposite.
Yeah, we do. Yep, you're right. Well, so Strider calls out to him too, and then Strider calls, and you want to take that Elvish stuff right there?
Sure. I don't really know Elvish pronunciation, but he calls to Strider, Aina Vedui Dunadan, Mei Govanen.
I think that was pretty good, Clifford.
Okay, thank you.
All right, finish it up. Rest of the bold.
His speech and clear ringing voice left no doubt in their hearts. The rider was of the elven folk. No others that dwelt in the wide world had a voice so fair to hear.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Strider, you know, introduces him. This is Glorfindel, who dwells in the house of Elrond. Glorfindel says, hail, and well met at last. He said he was sent from Rivendell because they had feared that there was going to be danger upon the road for their entrance there. And so right. Frodo's wondering, like, so did Gandalf make it to Rivendell then? And Glorfindel says, well, I left 9 days ago, so I hadn't heard news then. We had gotten news from basically Gildor. Gildor had told them.
Right.
Somehow he got messages out there. And then there's this long quote here that, we just got to read again. You know, lots of quotes this chapter. Okay. All right, I'll just go for this one. They said the Nine were abroad and that you were astray, a great burden without guidance, for Gandalf had not returned. There are a few even in Rivendell that can ride openly against the Nine, but such as there were, Elrond sent out north, west, and south. And then he goes on to say, it was my lot to take the road, and I came to the bridge Menethil, however you pronounce it last time, it was better than me, Menethil, and left a token there, nigh on 7 days ago. Three of the servants of Sauron were upon the bridge, and they withdrew, and I pursued them westward. I came also upon two others, but they turned away southward. Since then, I have searched for your trail. 2 days ago, I found it, and followed it over the bridge, and today I marked where you descended from the hills again. But come, there is no time for further news. Since you are here, we must risk the peril of the road and go on. There are five behind us, and when they find our trail upon the road, they will ride after us like the wind. And they are not all. Where the four may be, I do not know. I fear that we may find the ford is already held against us. Okay, so pretty good setup of the situation here. So right. He was the one that put the token on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And five behind, which are, I don't know, maybe even presumably the five that were at the camp. And then four might just be like, you know, cherry picking in the end zone. Like ready to get him at right. The last second if it comes to that.
Lying in wait.
Right.
And so that suddenly everything is urgent.
Right.
There's been a general sense of doom, but now the heat is on.
There's been doom, but Glorfindel shows up, and this is another example of like, hey, don't give up hope. There's other people, other forces, good forces at work here that are ready to help. And, you know, like, it's not the only messenger that's been sent out from Rivendell. There's other people, like, all going on, like, right. Ready to find these guys and help them. And it just happens that Glorfindel does.
Yeah, and it's worth noting here that When the folks in Rivendell, the elves, heard that Frodo and Strider and all were abroad without Gandalf specifically, basically like without a kind of very powerful guide with them,
yeah,
or some sort of like guardian angel almost, they were like, oh my god, we've gotta like scramble, get somebody out there to protect them,
right?
So certainly Strider's strong, but the fact that they didn't have somebody like of Gandalf's stature is a right. Danger, an urgent right. Danger.
The only other note before we get into Gildor's backstory here, Strider shows Gildor the dagger and retells like the whole attack that night. And so for them, they were like, well, you know, Frodo's pretty tired. He's pretty weary. He's got to rest. But Gildor's more like, well, yeah, that's all bad. And I know he's got to rest, but that's actually more so that we just got to go on. Like, we got to get there now. Like, we got to hurry up.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go further in this chapter, did I keep saying Gildor a couple times? Glorfindel's backstory.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, we have already met this guy.
Really?
Where have we met him? What other Glorfindel do we know?
I'm going to put my money on Gondolin.
Money?
From the
Silmarillion. Are you telling me that story is not just etched into your mind, Clifford? Where Glorfindel escapes from Gondolin with Tur and Arendil and Indul and all the other people that get out of Gondolin, and then he's up on the pinnacle fighting the Balrog that attacks him as they're trying to leave. Are you telling me you don't remember that?
That was actually all that was on the tip of my tongue.
Okay.
So
better have been. That guy's awesome. That story was awesome.
I the reason I thought of that is because I think that's the. We haven't done very much content that's not The Hobbit or Lord of the Rings. We've only done a few little glimpses back into the Silmarillion, but the Fall of Gondolin was, I think, our primary one.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And
well, at this point, theoretically, we should have recorded Beren and Lúthien, and that will be coming out before this episode. We haven't done it yet.
Well, Glorfindel is it harkens back to the Silmarillion. Yeah. Which means he is like kind of walking out of a legend.
Correct.
Right now.
Good idea. Cool.
You know, he's coming out of the old time into the current story, which is a pretty epic thing.
He's got the most epic bridge of all, I'd say, because in that same story where he fights the Balrog, he dies. Like, so how is he here alive? This doesn't make sense, right?
No, it doesn't.
Right, so here's the deal. When elves are slain in, like, battle or something, or, like, they somehow die from, like, an accident, like, maybe falling off a cliff or something, or whatever happens, you know? Mm-hmm. When they die, they go to basically like a House of the Dead place in Val. I think we'll talk about it at some point, so I don't really want to spoil it too much. Mando's owns it. I guess that's a spoiler. They go to Mando's, which is like a House of the Dead. And so that's where their spirit lives. I don't think they... Maybe they even get their bodies back. I don't think they quite get their bodies back. I don't think it was ever even fleshed out or like definitively said like how the elves... almost reincarnation works. But anyways, just assume that like something like that happens, and like, and this is a, as opposed to men, because like when men die, their spirits like leave like this whole universe, like it's out of there, like it goes back to Iluvatar, who's beyond the universe almost. But that's not true of elves.
Okay,
so Tolkien was writing around like in his later days, he never actually got around to writing it, but he meant to make Glorfindel this same Glorfindel, like he was reincarnated. And they said because of his actions there and his noble life in Gondolin, and then the actions where he fought the Balrog, they gave him his body back, and he was almost as strong as a Maiar. And so the Maiar are the minor gods, remember? And they're almost like like either Greek gods or like angels. You can think of them like that. So he's coming back, and yeah, like what you were saying, he sounded like an angel appearing. It's like, well, yeah, he's probably like this, possibly the strongest elf to right now. So yeah, yes. Like all that glowing stuff is like, okay, he earns it, you know, because he literally probably is showing like that. Because so Manwë sends him back to Middle Earth, which, and again, when a god sends you somewhere, when you're sent anywhere, you're like a messenger.
Manwë's like the main head, god, right?
He's like Zeus, but then you have to remember Iluvatar's still above him, but he's like Zeus, right? Yeah, think of him as Zeus.
Okay,
so he sends him back to Middle Earth. So anytime they say send, that means you're being, anybody sent, that means they're a messenger, right? You know, in some sort of way. And messenger and angel are the same word. Like, angelos is just messenger in Greek. So, yeah. So, again, he really is, like, yeah, messenger back to Middle Earth. Notably, big spoiler that I won't actually spoil, but just allude to, he probably came back with some other big-name travelers who we'll talk about later. Anyways, though.
So, this guy's a big deal.
Yeah, he is. Like, it's almost why is he, like, taking orders from Elrond, who... do we know this yet?
No, we don't know anything about Elrond yet. Really.
Okay. Anyways, it's almost, like, to the point where it's, like, how is he taking orders from Elrond? But whatever, you know? I guess he's fine with it, you know? And Elrond's fine with it, too.
Right.
But he goes back and...
We've seen so far the elves are kind of, like, a unified front, you know?
Yeah.
And at least in Lord of the Rings, we don't get any inter-elven conflict. You don't really only see that in Lord of the Rings, right? Or in the Silmarillion, sorry.
Well, you see in Lord of the Rings, they have like hierarchies within each tribe of them. Like there are multiple groups together, and then there's like the hierarchy in there. And it's almost like, dude, if this guy's an angel, how is he not at the top besides that he just came back?
Right, but for all intents and purposes right now, the elves are like, they're almost like a force in this world. Like they're a concerted group.
Yeah, yeah. There's no fact. Yeah.
Like they're not really, they don't fly solo.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, that's fair.
And so when Elrond and the folks in Rivendell are like, send out the cavalry, they really mean it if they're sending out Glorfindel.
Right, that's true.
Angel boy.
And he was probably like the best general in like any of the wars that led up to this. Because when he came back to Middle-earth, he dwelt in Rivendell, but then there were like a series of wars in the north against the evil kingdom Angmar, which, you know, Aragorn was referencing, like this whole land became like wicked men. You know, this is who Rivendell's elves were fighting. And Glorfindel was like basically the leader of that. And we don't quite know this yet, but since we already were talking about the ring race and how they were kings of men, some of them were the kings in these wars. And he was fighting against them. Like Glorfindel. Okay. And so that's also why he's pretty fearless to just ride against them openly with, you know, ringing bells, alerting anybody to his coming, you know, solo. And he's just prepared to like fight these things off. Like he's just like, I fought three off the bridge, I saw two others and I ran them down, you know. And so he's like, this guy's like a mighty guy who can actually handle this. And that's just in his history.
So that we've got a sense of like the sides are a little bit more even now with Glorfindel showing.
Well, they got a better chance now. Yeah.
Right. We also get the sense that there's like this ancient conflict. Like you just said, Glorfindel and likely some of the Black Riders, the evil kings of men, might have done battle in some form in this same land ages ago.
Not might have, did. Did.
Did. Okay, so the territory is important. The rivalry is important. It's like everything is supercharged.
Well, and yeah, to finish off the evening out, like giving him a better chance, Glorfindel finally gives Frodo his horse.
You shall ride my horse. I will shorten the stirrups up to the saddle skirts, and you must sit as tight as you can. But you need not fear. My horse will not let any rider fall that I command him to bear. His pace is light and smooth, and if danger presses too near, he will bear you away with a speed that even the black steeds of the enemy cannot rival. No, he will not, said Frodo. I shall not ride him, if I am to be carried off to Rivendell or anywhere else, leaving my friends behind in danger. Glorfindel smiled. I doubt very much, he said, if your friends would be in danger if you were not with them. The pursuit would follow you and leave us in peace, I think. It is you, Frodo, and that which you bear, that brings us all in peril.
Alright, so this is also kind of notable that Frodo has, like, the sentiment to not leave his friends, even though he's, mm-hmm. like, and, you know, he's the one in trouble. Like, you know, yeah. physically he's in trouble, he's the target and everything. But this is the second time this has happened. The first time, where he's just like, I'm not going to abandon you guys, no matter what.
No, help me out.
Burrow Downs, when they're in the mound, when he's in the mound, and so it's like, man, oh, I could yeah, totally okay. run away here, you know, like, slip on the ring, get out. Gandalf would understand, right, you know?
Right, when they're trapped inside the barrow. And yeah. the Barrow White is coming for them, and all of his friends seem just about condemned to be right. killed.
But yeah, so no man left behind in this story. That's, you know, running theme there.
Right, and then Glorfindel's like, it's not me, babe, it's you.
Yeah, well, so anyways, Glorfindel's still with them, and I guess Frodo gets to sit on the horse. But other than that, Glorfindel's setting a monster pace through the night. And the hobbits are, like, half asleep trying to keep up. Even Strider is getting slightly tired. The first sign of vulnerability we've ever heard this guy at all is, like, he was right. sagging a little bit.
Right. His shoulders were slumped. That said, it doesn't really sound like Strider sleeps. It kind of sounds like he always keeps watch at night.
Dude, Clifford, we're gonna spend, like, a real hardcore long session about Strider not getting sleep. That guy's my hero.
Okay.
I can totally relate. Okay. But anyways, they do sleep for a couple hours, though, at dawn, and Glorfindel keeps watch, mm-hmm. and then he gives him some liquor from, like, that silver flask or whatever, and that sounds like another magical thing mm-hmm. again, but then it also sounds like mythological, like, you know, mm-hmm. this is, like, invigorating drink or something, you know.
It's mm-hmm. Well, this will come up again and again right. with the elves. Yes,
yeah. You know, typical elf stuff to give. But anyways, it says they slept for like 5 hours, and they must have, and they said they started sleeping at dawn, so that means they're starting at around noon. It said after that day, by nightfall that day, they've covered 20 miles. So from, like, let's say like 11 o'clock to what, probably 6 o'clock, in 7 hours they do 20 miles. That's like mm-hmm. that's hauling. Like that, like, especially Hobbit small legs, that's hauling. Like, that was yeah. a good effort. And they're coming pretty close mm-hmm. to the fords, but it's still kind of far away, right?
Right, right.
And Glorfindel's still anxious, but they're all pretty, it's pretty clear that the Hobbits are completely exhausted and they gotta sleep for the night. Mm-hmm. So they wake up the next morning. This is it. Just let you know. So they wake up the next morning. They wake up the next morning.
Yeah. Brace yourselves.
They wake up the next morning, set out early. Hobbits are still weary, of course, duh. And there's still many miles to go to the ford, they say. And then Glorfindel says, our peril will be greatest just ere we reach the river, for my heart warns me that the pursuit is now swift behind us, and other dangers may be waiting by the ford. Yes. Yes, there are. This really reminded me of the final lap of Paris-Roubaix.
5 hours, 53 minutes of riding through hell. Is it going to be the biggest win of the Swiss champion's career? Is it going to be another monument for Peter Sagan? Sagan sits and has Delia exactly where he wants him at the moment. He's right on his wheel, ready to pounce. Shakes the legs. He's confident. He's ready. So much energy, ready to go. It's Delia who looks, tries to watch him like a hawk. They're well into the last half a lap now. Delia is there in the red and white of Agilis Elam on the other French team. The Swiss star on his red bike. And it's the world champion on the gold bike, approaching 250 meters to go. Last bend coming up. Sagan has him right where he wants him at the minute. But where is the moment that he launches his sprint? And there is Sagan who dives down. Sagan hits the front, but can he stay there? It is Peter Sagan. It is his moment. It is going to be the world champion in Roubaix for the first time since 81. It's Peter Sagan, arms aloft, and he has.
This is the end of the chapter, end of book one. You know, we were planning this out and we're just like, okay, it's really hard to just describe what happened in like a more concise way than the book itself. And mm-hmm. plus the mm-hmm. book does a good job. So like, we're just going to quote it at length here. Like why waste it? You know, right. This is a good scene. Like we right. should read it.
I, the advantage of us going through this and doing a chapter and episode is we condense a lot of things and we can bring in other information. But in the action sections of the book, if the action is happening so fast that our paraphrase is the same length as the action, there's no point to paraphrase.
Right. Yeah. So you want to take it?
The road was still running steadily downhill, and there was now in places much grass at either side, in which the hobbits walked when they could to ease their tired feet. In the late afternoon, they came to a place where the road went suddenly under the dark shadow of tall pine trees, and then plunged into a deep cutting with steep, moist walls of red stone. Echoes ran along as they hurried forward, and there seemed to be a sound of many footfalls following their own. All at once, as if through a gate of light, the road ran out again from the end of the tunnel into the open. There, at the bottom of a sharp incline, they saw before them a long, flat mile, and beyond that, the ford of Rivendell. On the further side, there was a steep brown bank, threaded by a winding path, and behind that, the tall mountains climbed, shoulder above shoulder, and peak beyond peak, into the fading sky. There was still an echo, as of following feet in the cutting behind them, a rushing noise as if a wind were rising and pouring through the branches of the pines. One moment, Glorfindel turned and listened. Then he sprang forward with a loud cry. "Fly!" he called. "Fly! The enemy is upon us!" The white horse leapt forward. The hobbits ran down the slope. Glorfindel and Strider followed as rear guard. They were only halfway across the flat when suddenly there was the noise of horses galloping. Out of the gate in the trees that they had just left rode a black rider. He reined his horse in and halted, swaying in his saddle. Another followed him, and then another, and then again two more. "Ride forward, ride!" cried Glorfindel to Frodo. He did not obey at once, for a strange reluctance seized him. Checking the horse to a walk, he turned and looked back. The riders seemed to sit upon their great steeds like threatening statues upon a hill, dark and solid, while all the woods and land about them receded as if into a mist. Suddenly he knew in his heart that they were silently commanding him to wait. Then at once fear and hatred awoke in him. His hand left the bridle and gripped the hilt of his sword, and with a red flash he drew it. "Ride on! Ride on!" cried Glorfindel, and then loud and clear he called to the horse in the elf tongue. "Nor-o-lim! Nor-o-lim! Asphaloth!" At once the white horse sprang away and sped like the wind along the last lap of the road. At the same moment the black horses leapt down the hill in pursuit, and from the riders came a terrible cry, such as Frodo had heard filling the woods with horror in the east farthing far away. It was answered, and to the dismay of Frodo and his friends, out from the trees and rocks away on the left, four other riders came flying. Two rode towards Frodo, two galloped madly towards the ford to cut off his escape. They seemed to him to run like the wind, and to grow swiftly larger and darker as their courses converged with his. Frodo looked back for a moment over his shoulder. He could no longer see his friends. The riders were falling back. Even their great steeds were no match in speed for the white elf horse of Glorfindel. He looked forward again, and hope faded. There seemed no chance of reaching the ford before he was cut off by the others that had lain in ambush. He could see them clearly now. They appeared to have cast aside their hoods and black cloaks, and they were robed in white and gray. Swords were naked in their pale hands, helms on their heads. Their cold eyes glittered, and they called to him with fell voices.
If these black riders, you know, trying to kill him weren't in the way, this really sounds like a pretty good, like, race description, you know, like of a track race or, like, you know, bike race. It's like, yeah. Dude, he can write that too.
Yeah, no, it's epic.
It's like last lap, you know, last 400 of a on the track is what this feels like.
I had a great professor in architecture school who taught us kind of about landscape architecture and how different landscapes get used for different types of buildings and uses and that type of thing. And he was joking, but there's a lot of times when landscapes get put to weird uses. And the professor said, you know, if you ever want to know what the highest and best use for a landscape is, or like what the most proper thing to do with it is, like, you look to Lord of the Rings. Like,
nice.
You know, he's like, what's a ridgeline for? It's like for the group running down a ridgeline, yeah. Or something like that. Or like every landscape is like synced up with the epic narrative, basically. Yeah. Which I think is a pretty cool detail. You mentioned it earlier, but yeah, once again, this is like a totally cool setup. They've come out of this slit in the rock, out of the trees. And now there's this straightaway. Yeah. There's the river that's the clear ending point, and everything's converging all at once. I thought the movie captured this part pretty well.
I mean, they added an Arwen, but yeah. I mean, other than that, and even that I thought was good.
They modified the setup a little bit, I guess. But this, like, sprinting through the trees,
right?
I thought was pretty well done.
One last thing before we keep going here, and we can talk about this more after we finish the whole thing, but like very notable when he says they're standing, like he's standing, like Frodo's waiting with the horse a little bit, and he can sense that the riders are commanding him to wait, and he says, then at once fear and hatred awoke in him. So like he hated, like he ended up hating the commands, and so like that's part of the, he drew his sword after that and was like really ready to like almost fight him right there.
With a red flash he drew it.
Right.
He drew us out a sword, like red with anger.
Yeah.
Another, out of curiosity, it sounds like he can see the riders in their true state, something like that.
That's because the wound's having so much of an effect on him.
So even though he doesn't have the ring on, he's sort of under its spell.
Yeah.
Because he's got that bit of sword inside.
Yeah, like he's really is, like, there's a chance he's becoming the Wraith. Like, he's under the shadow, you know? Like think about, like, the shadow, like, in his, like, a shadow right now, you know? Like, back to that.
Right. Or to use the analogy from earlier, like, he's got the harpoon in him, and they're kind of dragging him in. They're reeling him in.
And but the reeling is, like, it's not like they're physically getting close to him. It's more so, like, he's becoming one of them.
Yes.
Like a shadow himself. And he's under their shadow.
He doesn't choose to ride. He's ready to stand and try to fight these things.
Right.
Because he's refusing to ride, and Glorfindel kind of gives him an override command.
Right.
And tells the horse to run in Elvish.
Well, so we'll talk about the aid of the elves once we finish this up. But do you want, let's just kill this off.
Okay.
Let's get this done.
Okay. Well, yeah, the reason I asked is because he could see them clearly now. They appeared to have cast aside their hoods and black cloaks, and they were robed in white and gray. Swords were naked in their pale hands. Helms were on their heads. So this is what Frodo's seeing. Presumably, the rest of the group sees only shadows.
Yes.
On these horses.
Yes.
I thought it was interesting that they're robed in white and gray. You know, we've seen so much about darkness and then being shadows. This is like a suggestion maybe of the kings they once were, I'm guessing.
I think it's more just like, you know, it's like the pale, eerie, like ghosty stuff.
Okay.
I mean, it could go either way, but yeah.
But helms on their heads implies kings or warriors, I suppose.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Fear now filled all Frodo's mind. He thought no longer of his sword. No cry came from him. He shut his eyes and clung to the horse's mane. The wind whistled in his ears, and the bells upon the harness rang wild and shrill. A breath of deadly cold pierced him like a spear. As with a last spurt, like a flash of white fire, the elf horse, speeding as if on wings, passed right before the face of the foremost rider. Frodo heard the splash of water. It foamed about his feet. He felt the quick heave and surge as the horse left the river and struggled up the stony path. He was climbing the steep bank. He was across the ford. But the pursuers were close behind. At the top of the bank, the horse halted and turned about, neighing fiercely. There were 9 riders at the water's edge below, and Frodo's spirit quailed before the threat of their uplifted faces. He knew of nothing that would prevent them from crossing as easily as he had done, and he felt that it would be useless to try to escape over the long, uncertain path from the ford to the edge of Rivendell, if once the riders crossed. In any case, he felt that he was commanded urgently to halt. Hatred again stirred in him, but he had no longer the strength to refuse. Suddenly the foremost rider spurred his horse forward. It checked at the water and reared up. With a great effort, Frodo sat upright and brandished his sword. "Go back," he cried. "Go back to the land of Mordor, and follow me no more." His voice sounded thin and shrill in his own ears. The riders halted, but Frodo had not the power of Bombadil. His enemies laughed at him with a harsh and chilling laughter. "Come back, come back," they called. "To Mordor we will take you." "Go back," he whispered. "The ring, the ring," they cried with deadly voices, and immediately their leader urged his horse forward into the water, followed closely by 2 others. "By Elbereth and Lúthien the Fair," said Frodo with a last effort, lifting up his sword, "you shall have neither the ring nor me." Then the leader, who was now half across the ford, stood up menacing in his stirrups and raised up his hand. Frodo was stricken dumb. He felt his tongue cleave to his mouth and his heart laboring. His sword broke out and fell out of his shaking hand. The elf horse reared and snorted. The foremost of the black horses had almost set foot upon the shore. At that moment there came a roaring and a rushing, a noise of loud waters rolling many stones. Dimly Frodo saw the water below him rise, and down along its course there came a plumed cavalry of waves. White flames seemed to Frodo to flicker on their crests, and he half fancied that he saw amid the water white riders upon white horses with frothing manes. The 3 riders that were still in the midst of the ford were overwhelmed. They disappeared, buried suddenly under angry foam. Those that were behind drew back in dismay. With his last failing senses, Frodo heard cries, and it seemed to him that he saw, beyond the riders that hesitated on the shore, a shining figure of white light, and behind it ran small shadowy forms waving flames that flared red in the gray mist that was falling over the world. The black horses were filled with madness, and leaping forward in terror, they bore their riders into the rushing flood. Their piercing cries were drowned in the roaring of the river as it carried them away. Then Frodo felt himself falling, and the roaring and confusion seemed to rise and engulfed him together with his enemies. He heard and saw no more.
Ho, ho, ho! Big stuff. Big stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah, that was pretty good. What part do we want to hit first here?
I mean, yeah, that was pretty cool. That was an epic ending to the book, I'd say. There's a lot of things going on here. Frodo, he's almost, you know, he's fading really quickly. Whether this is a combination of just, like, exhaustion and being not healed, or he's actively, like, suffering from being near the riders, mm-hmm. seems like we've got a little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's, like, becoming more and more just, like, letting the horse carry him, barely hanging on. Luckily, this horse is amazing. Yeah. And then he makes it across the riders into the river. And I feel like we've got like, a handful of things all very important right in a row.
Well, let's talk about Frodo himself and then expand out from there. Because this is the other reason that we read the whole thing is, like, even though the movie did a good job with the scene, it doesn't all capture what's going on in Frodo's self, you know, like the inner conflict in him. Frodo, right. clearly, it makes it very clear. I just said clearly, like, how many times? Five. If he didn't have aid from the elves, like, from whoever sent the river rushing down, and Glorfindel, the ring race would have achieved their goal right here. Like, he would have come over to them and given them the ring. Like, that would have happened. And then, presumably, they would have killed him right there.
Right.
Or maybe they would have taken him and tortured him or something.
And this is specifically when you're describing when the leader of the Black Riders, who's in the ford, stands up in his stirrups and raises his hand.
Yeah. Right? Well, that's the final.
Frodo was stricken dumb. He was stricken dumb, and he felt his tongue cleave to his mouth and his heart laboring. His sword broke and fell out of his shaking hand. So, presumably, this is after he's mentioned the names of Elbereth and Luthien. Now the Black Rider is, like, enacting some very direct power on him. More than whatever's already influenced.
But this is also, like, maybe you can say that this is just, like, the dark power and this is what they have. But this is almost like, all right, well, it's also like the symbol of the ring. Like, there's, because the ring's like a symbol of sin. We've said that a couple times, you know? And then it's almost like saying, like, right. Well, is there just stuff that's, like, too powerful for us to overcome, at least by ourselves solo? And it's like, Tolkien would probably say yes, based off, like, this scene. It's like, okay, like, the ring and the ring race and the dark power surrounding the ring are all commanding him, and it's too strong for him to, you know, no matter how strong will he is, it's too strong for him to just battle by himself. Like, he needs external help.
Right. Right, we had discussed in previous chapters when Frodo is kind of struggling with the ring, and does he put it on, does he not put it on, something's compelling him to put it on, like, he's facing temptation, and does he have the willpower or the strength to resist that temptation? We're in a whole new situation here.
Yeah.
He's been stabbed, so he's weakened, but the stabbing has also kind of attached him to the enemy in a more
he still
way.
Has, like, pretty good, like, mindset here, because he, like, he hates these guys. Like, they're using the word hatred. Like, he hates what's going on here. He hates these people. And that's, like, pretty well directed. Like, these are the people that you should hate. You know, like, this is, like...
Yes,
like,
but I'm...
Well, go on.
I'm curious. I think we'll have to wait and talk about this more once we have some more information. I'm going to throw it out there right now that I think that hate is sort of an evil hate.
Mm.
Like, it's a corrupt hate,
like,
in the way
that...
Like,
because he wants to possess the ring.
Sort of in, like, a... Like, if it were, like, the most goodness... The best thing is if he can love his enemies as well, you know? And, like, it's, like, the power of his love is what he would, like, fight his enemies with.
But
instead, it's, like, the power of anger and like, destruction is, like, it's, like, a negative power. And that suggests that he's under the influence of the enemy, is for him to be red with rage.
I half agree, half disagree. Because if these guys are a symbol of evil and darkness and sin, like, let's just say that specifically, you know, the, like, evil and sin. It's like, okay, you should hate. I mean, you, like, you can still, like, if you take out the individual, you know, because there's like, in our case, you know, if somebody's being evil, there's still the human person there and you can love the person, but you can hate all their actions. These people are like the embodiment of evil actions. So it's like, yes, you should hate this. Like God hates sin, you know, but obviously he loves the sinner. Love the sinner, hate the sin, you know, but these guys are just all sin. But I also understand what you're saying too, like his hatred is somewhat corrupted.
I'm thinking of like, yeah, in like some descriptions of Christianity, and I think it'll come up again. I think it'll come up again in the story, is like the concept of like being consumed with hatred, and it's like self-hatred and hatred for others, including your oppressor who might be evil. And so it's like you hating the person who you're under the influence of. And it suggests that like the servants of Mordor, the servants of Sauron are like animated by hate. They're motivated by hate, and it might be hate of Sauron as well as hate of good things. And that hatred is like the fuel that drives them. And that's kind of what I'm thinking is here, is like, it's conceivable that like the Black Riders are consumed with rage, or like are just like hateful individuals in general. And like they may have no love for Sauron. They might hate this like sort of bondage that they're stuck in, and Frodo's being pulled into that.
Before the Tolkien and Lewis, I think, would have been aware of this, or they would have thought of this before the fall. Like before Nive fell, good and evil were totally separate, like black and white. Like there was no gray zones or anything. But now after the fall, everybody's has like some sort of like bad quality, like some bad part of them. You know, like nobody's perfect, right? And so it's like, so nobody's like angelic white anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so so from that perspective, where Frodo's hate's coming from, it's not coming from like the good place where like the good, like white hates black, right? It's his source of it's a little grayed, but he is hating something that's basically almost entirely, if not entirely, black and evil. And so that part's good, but the source of it, it's not quite, like, I would say. Does that make sense?
I think so. Well, we'll okay. come back to it later on.
I think we will come back to it later.
I'll be able to make the point better once we have some more of the story at hand. But the point is, he's consumed by anger facing them. I guess I should temper that. Another part of the reason I'm saying this, was making me think this, is it's this hatred of him trying to fight the riders that's actually coming at his peril. That the smartest thing and the best thing he could do is to ride away.
Yeah, that's true.
And instead, it's he thinks that he's doing something good and noble, turning to fight them, but it's actually very foolish,
right?
And would be very bad in general.
Okay.
And so it's like he can't see straight.
Yeah.
And so it's like he's under the influence of something else. Yeah. So he thinks he can stand up to them, but he can't.
Well, that leads into, you know, the external forces that helped him get through this. There's Glorfindel actually just like almost, not literally slapping the horse on the ass to go ride, but, you know, I mean, it was like, he's just like, get going. Like, he called to the horse, and the horse just obeyed his command. And then, when they're at the river, in that case, Frodo wasn't like, he didn't want to stand and fight him, besides that it's just like, well, we can't just keep this pursuit going much longer, you know? So he's just like, all right, this is maybe the final stand place, which is, like, logical at that point. Like, I don't think hates, like, clouding his judgment at that point. But he's there.
Well, I would temper it and say he outran the rider so far pretty well with this amazing horse. And even if it would be really hard for the horse to race all the way to Rivendell, whatever horse racing is going on, he could win the horse race, is the suggestion.
Yeah, but he might be scared that the riders could still capture him in Rivendell. You know, like Rivendell is not strong enough to stand up against one of them. Which is probably not true because of literally what happens in this river, but I don't know. Well, anyways, the water, though, comes down, and it's, like, in the kind of, like, the shape of the horses, and it, like, mows down the three Black Riders, right? And the river's rushing past.
Right.
And they're like, we don't know where that comes from, but we can presume that those are good forces, especially since he says, by Elbereth and Lúthien the Fair, you know, he's calling out good names, like, good protectors to help him out again.
So was this huge wave that comes down, do you think it was summoned by Frodo, by him saying, by Elbereth and Lúthien the Fair, you shall have neither the ring nor me?
I think we got to wait and get more information, but I think that helped.
Okay. Because you could also, maybe we could also read it as like, he says that to the Black Riders, and that's like a heavy blow to them, and that so angers the leader that then he kind of hits back with this like this like iron grip from afar that he like almost, it sounds like almost like choking Frodo with, and that's like his counterpunch. And then something else comes in independent of Frodo and knocks him out.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, well, Frodo himself, I don't think, summoned the water at all. But him invoking Elbereth, and then Lúthien too in this case, triggered something else to happen from somewhere, okay. Like some okay. other external force to come and help. And
okay, you know, interesting.
And if Frodo hadn't done that, maybe no help comes. But Frodo didn't, like, save himself there. He just invoked somebody else to save him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And whether, if we, when we find out the real events, like, are we going to find out Elbereth's got any connection to this? Well, she's not literally in any part of the story. Like, we're never going to meet Elbereth in the story. But maybe she could have influenced those other characters within the story that did trigger this to happen.
Okay, okay.
And the last notable one that I'll say, too, it says that second to last paragraph, with his failing senses, Frodo heard cries, and it seemed to him that he saw, beyond the riders that hesitated on the door, a shining figure of white light, and behind him ran small shadowy forms with flame, waving flames that flared red with the gray mist that was falling over the world. So did you pick up what that is?
The shining figure has got to be Glorfindel, Angel Boy, and the small shadowy figures are the hobbits.
Right. So it sounds like
torches of fire.
So it sounds like while all this is going on, Glorfindel like Bear Grylls it and starts a fire real quick, grabs some torches, and then they just push the rest of them in. Scare the rest.
I feel like Glorfindel's the type of character who can just snap and fire appears in his hand.
Yeah, but there, maybe, but well, yeah, Gandalf can do it because we already seen Gandalf do it. Whatever, fine. Bear Grylls though.
Point being, this is the rest of the crew who is left back behind all of this epic pursuit and in the dust, have now kind of charged forward in the meantime with some flaming sticks and glowing Glorfindel, and they.
I imagine Glorfindel looks extra glowy right now too.
Yes, he's actively emitting light. Whereas before, not quite.
Some maybe veiled, yeah.
But they do the very effective thing of chasing these other six horses and riders into the river where they're washed away by the flood. The flood itself, I mean, I feel like you've got a lot of precedent for like the idea of like a cleansing flood.
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Washing away the evil.
Yeah. It fits in with mythology real easily. Like you see
sort,
that
yeah, sort of like a redeeming flood or something like that.
Yeah.
On that note, it seems like Frodo has like is falling. He's falling under the spell of the riders more and more and more. He's fading from consciousness. He's losing strength. He's losing his ability to resist. And he's basically right about to hit rock bottom when this sort of flood saves him and like wipes the evil away from him. At least
yeah,
for
it's
moment.
Also like parting the Red Sea kind of miracle last second.
Right, that's true.
In your flocks, we must go with old speed.
Yes. Go where? To drown in the sea? How long will the fire hold Pharaoh back?
Will it hold?
After this day, you shall see his chariots no more.
No! You'll be dead under them.
The Lord of hosts will do battle for us. Behold his mighty hand. The sea with the blast of his nostrils. Lead them through the midst of the waters. His will be done.
This is probably like the touch of you catastrophe, which we talked about in the end of The Hobbit a little bit, like the sudden turn for a good ending, you know, like, because everything, besides that we knew that the chapter was about to end, but even though we knew the chapter was about to end, it's like, okay, Frodo is screwed here until all of a sudden this miraculous waterish miracle happens, you know.
Right. I think what's interesting to me though is maybe the extent to which Frodo is like is not the most active character here, you know what I mean?
Like, that's what the Eucatastrophe is kind of about, is like, yeah, he's not, it's the outside force that comes and helps.
An ending we could have imagined is like everything looks like it's lost, and at the last moment Frodo like summons some last reserve of strength or willpower or something like that, or stabs a black rod or who knows what it is. Like, he himself does something that like seals his fate for the moment. But instead he's basically on his way out. Like, he's done for. And something external to him saves the day.
Clifford, you're hitting on a conversation that I want to have much deeper into the book, but
okay.
Like, you're okay, exactly fine. Hitting on it. Okay. So I think we're going to leave it there. But, you know, nonetheless, though, okay, Black Riders seems like they took a big hit here, but I mean, this chapter still ends as a cliffhanger. Like, we don't know what's going to happen to Frodo. Like, I mean, like you just said, it's like, yeah, he's fading, and it's like, well, is he even going to make it? You know, if you turn the page, you'll quickly see, but but we're gonna make you wait a little bit. You know, we're gonna take a couple weeks off, so. But I don't know, anything else for this chapter?
Well, the second to last line before the last line, he heard and saw no more, second to last line, I feel like is pretty loaded. I want to talk about it for a second. Then Frodo felt himself falling, and the roaring and confusion seemed to rise and engulf him together with his enemies. That to me, like, speaking of cliffhanger, suggests that he's almost being pulled, like, the Black Riders have been washed away, but he's kind of being pulled down with them.
If we're using that harpoon analogy, it's like, okay, he was literally right off the side of the boat, probably, like, hitting the boat. Like, they were probably pulling him out of the water at this point.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, and then a storm hits the boat.
Right, yeah. Or lightning strikes the boat or something, and then he snaps off.
So right.
Maybe. Well, we don't even know if he snaps off. Maybe it sounds like he's going down with the boat.
Right, so it's a scary ending, I'd say.
Yeah. Big things. But after a slow start, book one, pretty good ending. Like, last two chapters, pretty action-packed, I'd say. Even though it wasn't, like, sword fighting and battles, but it was still...
Definitely. The last chapter was, I feel like, a little bit of a microcosm of the larger book, where, you know, they're going, and then the action just, like, really accelerates towards the end. That said, though, we learned quite a lot from this chapter. We've got a ton of setup. It does seem like, right now, Tom Bombadil was just a diversion. That was a... You know, a detour on their path, but certainly important. There was that little line when Frodo's trying to resist the Black Riders, and he's telling them to go back to Mordor. It says the Riders halted, but Frodo had not the power of Bombadil. So certainly, resonant character.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Any other big thoughts?
Just real quick, because now we're just over time. You know, they saw the trolls this chapter. That was chapter 2 of The Hobbit. This is chapter 12 of this book.
Plus, that's a good point.
It's just like, geez, they milked it here. And
yeah,
what I also say, I have to go back and read the drafts, and I think we're probably gonna want to add a section about Trotter either to this chapter or the past chapter. Maybe you've already heard it if it's a past chapter, but like, I'm pretty sure, you know, like, these last two chapters from the Shire to Bree was like a 3-day ride, and that was like 8 chapters. You know, and then Bree was 2
days. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we do like, what, 3 weeks and 2 chapters, you know? So it's like,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
And that's because I think the key line there would be like in the last chapter, Aragorn says, oh, and the ring draws them. Like, that wasn't a connection when they were in the Shire, when he was first starting out the story. And that was a connection when they were in the Old Forest with Bombadil. It's just like, I think like the ring drew him was like a very late development. Like, in this way, as he's writing these sections of the book, and it's just like, oh, well, that's easy. You know, like, that would be so key. Like, yeah, they're turning, and that's always going to draw him there and everything.
So not only does that put Frodo and the hobbits in the hot seat in terms of having to move quickly, but you think Tolkien, as he was writing this, was also like restructuring the pace of the story after coming to that conclusion?
That was probably around the time where it's just like, oh yeah, this story's about the ring, because it wasn't really about the ring yet. It was just about originally it was just about maybe going on some adventure. Their first stop's Rivendell. Maybe they're going to find Bilbo, you know, and then, oh, there's these Black Riders around, and maybe they're looking for Frodo because they were looking for Bilbo, and maybe he knew it was because they had the ring, but it's just like, no. The ring is the central focus of the story, and as soon as they get that, because he figures it out maybe sometime around Bree, then the story takes off, you know, and that explains how these chapters get so much quicker.
Yeah.
Well, they're longer, but there's a lot of stuff going on, and they're also more action-y and suspenseful. Other than that, though, I think that's about all I got. This one, to let you know what's going on, book two should be good. Six of the way through, Clifford, six of the way.
They're starting to think about it. Peter has a look. Is he going to run out of steam at the very last? He'll take this turn with 6:50 to go. And here they are. Everyone has to be tired here. But who more than anybody else?
Rigoberto Urán is coming up for Colombo. We saw him do it in Montreal, but still he finds the gear. He searches for the energy. Has he got it? His mouth agape in protest. Fighting the gradient. The finish straight opens out. Has Peter Sagan of Slovakia got enough?
Well, here he goes. Peter Sagan is on a march. The world is watching Sagan. He's a lonely figure on occasion, and Rigoberto Urán has picked this up as well. He's the man who's going to chase him down potentially and break his heart, but it's a massive heart for Peter Sagan, and I think he's got what it takes. The camera is not at the finish line, don't forget. It stalls back again. He's racing on. Can he deliver? Urán's starting to fade as well. I think that's his chase at an end. Peter Sagan is going to deliver, and there is no worthier champion on the planet than this man. 200 meters to go. Oh, it's still not over. They're spinning it up like a gun behind him. He knows so he gets out of the saddle. He hits the sleeping policeman. He's still got 150 meters to go. He double checks again. Is he thinking about how to celebrate? Oh, it looks that way. Sagan's going to make it. Sagan the king. Sagan the world champion. What a race that was. And what a worthy wearer of the rainbows we have. Oh, chapeau, sir.
All right, nice. Clifford, we're back.
Yes, we are.
For the end here, chapter 12. That was a good one. It's a long episode. It's going to be a little longer because we got a little bit of stuff to say. Yeah, so I wanted to recap on some of the draft stuff of past chapters because we haven't hit that since we met Trotter. You remember him?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The old name for Strider.
Right, and he was back a hobbit.
When Frodo was still...
Bingo.
Bingo.
But Trotter was the hobbit with wooden shoes. but anyways, I want to just go through a little bit of stuff here. It's kind of interesting, though, because like even with that major change, it's still kind of the same story throughout. Okay. And that's really just like that's the running theme of like at least the first book of drafts. He basically gets the scenes right how we imagine them and how we read them, like close to word for word for lots of the stuff. But he doesn't have any of the background context for it at all. So it's not quite as suspenseful because it's just like, well, yeah. I mean, case in point would be after they left Bree, he was sketching outlining the story a little bit for like what he should do next. And he definitely had the flight to the Ford part in mind where they're all going to attack him at the Ford at the end of chapter 12 here. But he had no idea about like the attack on Weathertop. Basically, I don't even think that occurred to him until he suddenly wrote down when they were on the top of Weathertop that they just had to get down because the Black Riders were there. And so then after that, he's just like, well, I guess we're doing this, you know, we're going to have an attack on him and like, you know, with the knife and everything. But that scene, he nails completely. Like, it's the exact same thing as what we read. Even though, like, at this point, he didn't know the significance of the ring. Like, he vaguely knew, like, okay, they're going to have to destroy the ring and throw it into a volcano fire thing. Okay.
Right, okay.
Like, he kind of knew that. But he didn't know about Mordor. He didn't know about, like, what the background of the Black Riders were, even though in this scene he made them, like, the kings under the wrappings, you know, and with the crowns and everything. But he didn't even know that the One Ring was like the ruling ring. Like, that was not a concept yet. It's like he knew the power of the ring, but he didn't know any like the whole background of it.
So in some ways we were talking about how much depth and backstory is built into this story and how that it just makes it so fascinating. Like, I feel a little bit like you're walking through a room where you catch these reflections of other rooms or something like that.
Yeah.
Where you understand that there's an entire world out there and you're just witnessing some little piece of it. You're saying in the draft, he just hadn't built out all of that yet, but he was almost dead on in terms of the actual plot events.
Right. I mean, yeah, he had like all the scenes, like the flight to the Ford scene, like he had all that. He even had the writer say like, come with us to Mordor, basically, which is like, that was the first time he even recorded the word Mordor. Like, he didn't know what it was, but I don't know. It's
an interesting process to reflect on because
yeah,
I mean, it's easy to read the story and
recognize how much effort and complexity was woven into the whole thing. But to consider his process this way, it sounds like maybe he just had like the knack for pulling out the plot just like that, just super quickly and easily. And he spent a ton of time working in the backstory.
Yeah, he had to make the backstory fit. And that, I think, takes like iterations. We'll probably talk about that early in book two. A couple other things, though, for tonight. Obviously, the sad news is Christopher Tolkien passed away this week. Son of J.R.R. Tolkien. Without him, the Silmarillion doesn't get published. None of the notes get published. Whatever this future Amazon TV show is doesn't happen. It's a big deal. It's pretty sad. But then again, he was 95, so it's probably a full life, so that's pretty good.
Yeah. Definitely did a lot to, I guess, further the legacy of his father.
Right, and not just his dad. You know, like, I don't want to just, like, make it sound like he just did, like, devoted his whole life to his dad's work. Because he was, like, he was a scholar in his own right. But he did enhance our knowledge just of Middle Earth in general. Which, you know, obviously that comes from his dad's mind. And it was all of the great things that you can learn from anything in Tolkien. You know, Christopher Tolkien really helped put that forward. I was reading, like, obituaries and stuff about him from, like, some of the sites, and the coolest thing I came across was, because he grew up with, like, the Silmarillion especially. As a kid, like, his dad was just already telling the stories because he was already working at them. And Lord of the Rings, basically, his dad started writing that while he was a teenager, and then as he was a young adult in the war, and he was, like, literally shipping manuscripts to him across, like, because he was stationed in South Africa during World War II. Mm-hmm. And
Tolkien was, or Christopher Tolkien was?
Tolkien was shipping them to Christopher Tolkien, gotcha. You know, to get his opinion on stuff.
Okay.
And, but there was this cool line there. He said he grew up in the world that his father created, and he says, for me, the cities of the Silmarillion, so that's, like, Gondolin and Doriath and, you know, Hithlum and everything in Valinor. He says, those cities are more real than Babylon or any of, like, the ancient cities of, like, real time, which is, like, pretty crazy, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Interesting childhood to have there.
Definitely.
We're in debt to him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So our Beren and Luthien Part 1 special is out. So go check that out if you haven't. We worked pretty hard at it. I kind of like how it came out. So Part 2 to come soon. Ideally this, like, Sunday. If it's not Sunday, then it's probably going to be as soon as I can do it after. But it should be Sunday. And but then after that, we're going to take a break for a little bit. Because we got to regroup. We'll leave you in suspense because it's, you know, in between book one and book two of The Lord of the Rings as a whole. So, you excited for a break, even though we're not going to take a break?
Yeah, I think so. Need some time to digest everything we've been through so far and brace ourselves for book two.
Now, before we start book two, too, the original idea when I laid out, like, the plan for the show was we do all the books, take a break in between each, but what we do is we throw in one special there. Now this Beren and Luthien one just happened to come up anyway, so we just did it. Like, we'll do the specials as they come anyways, but I wanted to lay out, like, one special for after each book. And so what we will do in between book one and book two is the Music of the Ainur, which is basically the creation story of Middle Earth. So get excited for that, because I got big plans. Hopefully cool. Hopefully we pull it off. Anything else for you? How you been?
Been good. Not much to report.
Dude, you? I did my century ride this weekend.
Yeah, for the non-bikers out there, that's 100 miles.
Yeah. Okay, so I can report back that I really thought this would help. Tinfoil over your socks and in between your shoes for a 100-mile ride when it's really cold doesn't do anything. So we now have that out of the way. That is not a thing.
Let it be added to the annals of bike lore.
Mm-hmm. Dude, speaking of bike lore, I'm still in the process of editing it. I probably went off the rails with the idea that this horse chase felt like a race. So I've clipped in a bunch of race commentary at this point.
Awesome.
So I hope you enjoyed that. Hope it wasn't too much. I probably won't have an opportunity to do it again. So, you know, grab the bull by the horns on that one.
Nice.
You probably heard Peter Sagan's Paris-Roubaix win, and you probably heard Peter Sagan's Richmond 2015 World Championship win. And you will probably, why don't we end it here with Matthew Vanderpool's Amstel Goldwind from 2019 here. It was one of the best finishes, the best finish I've ever seen to a race.
There's the final turn. Wow. It's tail crosswind for the final K now. And it's Alaphilippe at the front. And they're about to be joined by a whole new group. And Van der Poel and company might do it yet. What an exceptional day. Here comes Kwiatkowski. Left-hand side hits the front and he's right back in the game. How did they let them do this? Alaphilippe behind. Kwiatkowski at the front and Fuglsang in third place. 600 metres to go, but we've got a group of other riders still ready to go.
Kwiatkowski is now towing Alaphilippe to the finish.
400 metres. Van der Poel behind, Clark with him, Schachman, Balde, Madois, there's Lambrecht, Trentin, Demarchi and Mollema, but it's the front three we're occupying ourselves with at the moment. This still could be anybody's. We've had one breathless finish already today. We're going to have another now inside the final couple of hundred metres. It's Alaphilippe who takes up on the right-hand side. Look at Van der Poel going from behind, though. Look at Van der Poel on the left-hand side. Mathieu Van der Poel's going to do it. Mathieu Van der Poel, this is incredible. Has a home.